Her talk is called The Snake, From Goddess to Satan to Doctor. She created the website The Faithless Feminist, and it's a platform for women to discuss why they left religion. So it's geared specifically towards women and non-religious women. She also wrote the book Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion, and it encompasses 22 stories from 22 women about how they discovered life without religion. So, without further ado, Karen.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to come back to my alma mater. Few years back, I was here from 73 till 80, and my friend Jean and I were in curriculum and instruction, and we both got PhDs. Yay! Of course, the only time I used mine was on my book that said Karen Carr's PhD, but I was glad I was able to recycle it. So, you're probably wondering, what is this older woman doing up here writing a book? I retired in 2008. I was executive director of the Oregon State Bar, happy to leave, spent the first 5 years doing my genealogy. Traced my ancestors back to 1635, found out I had a patriot and joined the Daughters of American Revolution. Reading mystery novels, great time. What happened? In June of 2014, the United States Supreme Court issued a decision in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby. Who knows about that? Yeah, okay. I was livid. This is a craft store called Hobby Lobby that is in Oklahoma, and she, there just happened to be a tornado, Matt told me, and that was the only store that was destroyed a year ago. Can I say Providence? Yes. And the Green family, very evangelical, said, we do not want to provide certain abortifacients, morning after pill, IUD, etc. And the Supreme Court had previously decided in Citizens United that, guess what? Corporations are people. Cool. Well, if corporations are people, then they can have religious views, right? So based on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, which required the least restrictive means if you're going to impose something from the government, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision said, well, we're already paying for those same abortifacients for religious institutions, the government pays them, so we'll do that. And I was just livid. When I was in Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota as an undergrad, 1968, I was working on the school newspaper, and we put in a little ad about the abortion clinic in New York because it was the only place that was illegal at the time. The president impounded all the newspapers and destroyed them all. They were never distributed. So back in the day when abortion wasn't legal, birth control was just coming, I said, and to you young women in the audience, it's not fair. We went through that. We suffered. I don't want it to happen to you. I was having lunch with a friend of mine who's an author. She said, you should write a book. And I said, well, the only thing I can get pissed about is religion. So I started calling friends. Are you an atheist? Are you an atheist? Are you an atheist? And then I joined several groups, the humanists of Greater Portland, the Center for Inquiry, and got additional people who were interested in writing. And then I reached out through social media. And so these 22 women from 18 to 70 tell their stories of leaving religion. And I was so pleased that they were all willing to do that. Now, some do have pseudonyms. But I hope you have an opportunity to read it. I was in a room of one's own today, and they had it. I had to take a picture of the shelf, my book on a shelf at a bookstore. It was so much fun. And in case you don't remember it, there are cards on the table, and they also have my website. Now, when you write a book today, can you just write a book? No, you have to do all of this other stuff. So I kind of got online and hired this marketing guy. And he said, you got to have a blog, got to write, got to get there every week to get the attention. You have to have a YouTube. You have to have Twitter. What's Twitter? So I said, okay, I'll do it. And we were brainstorming names, and the first name he came up with for the blog was Godless Grandmother. You know, I said, could we not emphasize my age, please? Thank you. So we called it Faithless Feminist. I had no idea how that word had changed. I mean, I'm talking Gloria Steinem, Coretta Scott King, all these people in the 60s and 70s. It was a great word. It meant gender equality, right? It's changed a little bit. Every once in a while, I'll get somebody on my blog who kind of fights back on that word, and then I teach them. So as I was doing this book, in the appendix is a subjugation of women in the Bible. I read the Bible cover to cover. Had never done that before. Whew, yeah. But I also read a lot of books, and I read a lot about mythology. And I didn't remember much from my senior year in high school reading Edith Hamilton's mythology book. Anybody read that one? Yeah. Thank you. But I'll tell you, when we did read it, it had nothing to do with the religion and the churches we were going to. That was mythology. But one of the things I discovered was there was a mother goddess. Early on, there was a feminine divine, and it had been completely eliminated. And one of the presentations I do that I hope to have on my website soon is From Goddess to God, Elimination of the Feminine Divine. But Vijay, I want to thank him. He was one of my subscribers. He said, oh, but you wrote this post about the devil. Could you really do something about the devil? And so I said, sure. And I pulled that out and made a different presentation for tonight. As I was at this bookstore, I bought a book on atheism that I hadn't read, surprising. My husband would swear I've read every one of them. Atheism, The Case Against God by George Smith. The atheist is pitted against morality itself, and the struggle between belief in a God and godlessness is viewed as a struggle between good and evil. And it follows up on what you said earlier, but I think that's why it's a really good topic. So, here we go. Who's afraid of snakes? Oh, you got somebody you can hold hands with? Okay, because we're going to show some pictures. What is culture? Who likes pizza? Great. Has anyone...
I didn't like pizza. I didn't smell of pizza.
Has anyone done any painting? How about speak a foreign language? Chinese food? Anyone can polka? Okay, great. those are all pieces of culture. So how does culture reproduce itself? How do we get pizzas? How do we learn about the polka? How do those...
Monkey see and monkey do.
That's one way to say it. Several. Language. The last time I gave a presentation, somebody told me that they had read that language went back a million years. And we don't really know. They look at the structure of the skeleton to see, could there have been a larynx there? Could there be a possibility? But at least by 100,000 years ago, there was language. Imagine what it was like to be able to say what your grandfather told you and pass that on to your child. Because if you didn't have language, you couldn't do that. It radically changed the tribe and how people communicated. Another one is ritual. 65,000 years ago, in a cave called Rigourdou, a French cave, they found a skeleton that had been neatly laid out with bare bones that had been cleaned on either side of it. There was red ochre over the skeleton, and there was a fire nearby. One of the earliest things we had to deal with is, what happens when we die? What happens to our ancestors? And they wanted to do something special. And there are Neanderthal caves where they've discovered this same kind of ritual, not even Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal caves. So these are things that get passed and carried on. Ritual is very important. Music. Who has sung in a choir? My sister and I were traveling a while ago, and we sang all the songs from church. that we could only remember the first verse. You never can remember the second or third. And we had the best time. When I was in high school, in the youth choir, we marched down the aisle singing God's Word is Our Great Heritage. We used to do that as kids later on as adults. Because it was a ritual. It felt good. It was pomp and circumstance. So those things get passed on. Maybe the ritual of polka. Images. And music is probably 50,000 years ago. They think it arose in Africa. Images. The French caves. In the back of the cave, not in the front where the hearth is, but in the back of the cave, there are the paintings. This is where the shaman went with the boys to teach them about the hunt. And those paintings are painted over and over and over again. So it's part ritual, it's through images, it helps teach, and that keeps culture going. Finally, writing, about 3000 BCE. I did watch a documentary the other day where there was a civilization in Egypt that used a kind of a form of a hieroglyph that they said they were competing with cuneiform in Mesopotamia. So we're probably not exactly sure where it rose, but that certainly changed a lot. I believe that religion is probably the last impediment to gender equality. And that's why I started a blog about why women should leave religion. I do not think we can have true gender equality with religion. So the goddess. Let's start out. We're going to talk about snakes, right? So the first thing that was associated with a snake was the goddess. James Melhart and Marija Gimbutas in the 50s and 60s looked at things a little differently, particularly Marija's, because this is when women archaeologists are first entering the profession, and they start to look at these things and have a little different eye toward them. And she studied Bronze Age Europe, and she said there was worship of a goddess. And I think her studies have been corroborated since then. When these were carved, people were saying, well, what's happening on this earth? Where do we go when we die? Look at the cycles of nature, the moon, and look at woman. Can you imagine a Paleolithic person knowing that the woman's menstrual cycle was the same as the lunar cycle? I mean, that had to be like, well, isn't that cool? And a woman menstruated, she bled. What did bleed mean for the warrior? Death. But the woman bled and didn't die. So this cycles of nature. On the one on the right from France, she's holding a horn and there's 13 stripes to it. The 13 lunar months, possibly. Or there's 13 days between one of the two of the cycles of the moon could be. She's holding herself. She may be pregnant. A lot of these figurines, the vast majority of them are women. Now, we're never going to know why they carved them. Somebody at one of my presentations said, well, maybe they were sex toys. And I said, you know, I really don't think so. That's kind of hard stone. I'm not sure you'd want to use that. In Çatalhöyük in Turkey, this one on the left, that was one of the areas where Marija Gimbutas did a lot of her work. This is a grain goddess. It was found in a grain bin. This was going to help the crops. And she's sitting on a throne. There's two lions there. Some people think she's having a child. It's not really sure. But that was done on purpose. And then here, these are clay pillars, and I had the opportunity to be in the British Museum a couple years ago. They're only this big. So these were female figurines that were placed in the home. Maybe somebody lit a candle, maybe had incense, but it was kind of a private worship, if you will. So that's the image of the goddess. And if anyone says there weren't any female divinities, you just tell them Karen Garsh told you, yes, there were. Okay? So now we're going to talk about the snake. One of the things that the snake symbolizes is rebirth. This is called an Ouroboros, and it's both in Egyptian art and Greek art, and it's the cycle again. And what does a snake do? Hibernates. Come out of ground, hibernates, come back. So it mimics the cycles of nature, just like we talked about the goddess, right? So it makes sense that they would be associated. And the snake loses its skin, which is pretty cool, and rejuvenates its skin. Wish I could do that. It also represents nature and fertility. It looks like the meanders of the river. It looks like the roots of trees and plants. It looks like the umbilical cord. So these are the symbols that go with the goddess, fertility, obviously, nature. So what better symbol could you have for the goddess than the snake? This is an Egyptian statue of Wadjet. And you can see she has a lion for a face, but up there on the top is a cobra. So you see in multiple cultures the snake representing female, either divine or female authority. Healing. The snake has venom. And the venom of the snake was associated with herbs and plants that could either heal you, kill you, or maybe change your consciousness. So this is one of the reasons, again, that the snake gets associated with the goddess. Now, would you like to mess with her? Oh, I wouldn't mess with her. No, I mean, she's there. She's got seven layers on her skirt, sun and moon, five known planets, could have been 7 days of the week. She's got a something on top of her head, and I don't know whether that's a bird or a cat, but she's holding these two snakes, and that's from Minoan Crete. On the right, you can't see this one very well, but there's lines on her body that represent the snake. And then finally, in Iraq, we're going to talk about these symbols later. What do we have? We have a tree, we have a snake, we have a goddess. We don't know whether that's a consort to the goddess, or it could be somebody who's asking something from her. So, snake and goddess. Got it? Okay. How do you turn a positive to a negative in 700 words? Genesis chapter 3. Yeah. Okay. What's here? A tree and a snake. These are the symbols, particularly the tree. The tree was associated with Asherah, who, if you read the Old Testament, they talk about Asherah. This was a goddess they worshipped in nature. They worshipped her near a pole or a tree. The word means both the goddess Asherah and the actual tree. We saw the tree before with a symbol of the goddess. We see the snake turning everything on its head. All of those positive images about the snake, healing, all of these, rebirth, all of those type of things, nature, fertility. Now the snake's the bad guy. Totally turned its on its head in 700 words. What happens as a result of this story? They're banned from paradise, kicked out. A woman must obey her husband. You have to work hard in the fields. You have to wear clothes. That's, of course, in Wisconsin, that's probably a pretty good idea. And pain in childbirth, this one in particular. I'm sorry, any women would like to go and redo that one? Yeah. I remember having our child, and my husband said, well, okay, you just keep on breathing. I said, I'm having an epidural. You go in the corner, you breathe. Sex is bad? The exact opposite of what was true with the goddess. And who is old enough never to have had any sex education in school? There you go. Yeah, absolutely nothing. I remember running home from school in fifth grade when we had the store, it's actually Kotex and Disney who did this explaining about menstruation. This movie was so obtuse, I didn't get it. I ran in the house and say, hey, Mom, what's menstruation? And after she explained it to me, I never said the word aloud again, of course, but she never explained the male and the female. She explained the movie to me, so I got that. So when I had my period, I knew about it. But there was nothing about sex education. I took a copy of my sister's book, Harold Robbins, 79 Park Avenue, and read it. And great way to learn about sex, the store owner rapes a young girl. That's how I learned about sex. And of course, because I had read the book, I was in junior high, and somebody was saying whores, and I said, it's not whore, it's war. It's W-H-O-R-E. Obviously, I was a little embarrassed because I still remember that. So this is turning everything from the goddess on its head. So next we're going to go talk to us about Satan. This is a transformation from a snake to an angel to the devil. Who learned that the snake in Genesis was Satan? Wrong. Prior to the exile to Babylonia, there really wasn't this duality of good and evil. The snake was a snake. Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. It was an animal. It wasn't evil. It wasn't Satan. It was just a snake. Now, the snake did get punished. Cursed are you above all livestock and all wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the day of your life. So it wasn't a good outcome, but it wasn't the devil. It wasn't the embodiment of evil at all. Not in that story. God was responsible for good and evil. In the beginning, God was responsible for both. I form the light and create darkness. I bring prosperity and create disaster. I, the Lord, do all these things. That may have been trying to emphasize that we believe in one God, because we're going to talk about where the notion of good and evil came, and they were different. So I think this may have, Isaiah may have written this to say, no, we just have one God, and they're responsible for good and evil. There's not another being there. After the exile in Babylonia, there is a character in the Bible called Satan. And it really is an accuser. It's still not the one you think of. Okay, we've left the snake behind, and now we have somebody who's an accuser or an opposer. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. Sometimes this is called the sons of God instead of the angels. So Satan is part of this group. He's not an entity opposite God or equal in strength to God at all. The Lord said to Satan. Satan came to the Lord, and the Lord was saying how good Job was. Oh, man, he's such a great guy. He believes in me. He does everything. And Satan said, why shouldn't he? He's got all this land. He's got wives. He's got kids. Everything's great. So God says, well, okay, he's in your hands, but don't kill him. So he's using Satan to tempt somebody or to accuse them or oppose them. Then he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. So it's not a snake anymore, but it's not quite the devil that you're thinking of. Satan stood up against Israel and incited David to number Israel. I've never figured out what was wrong with taking a census, but evidently it was a bad thing to do. In an earlier version of this, it's God who's asking him to take a census. So now we start getting a character in there that's different. So good and evil. Prior to, as I said, the exile in Babylonia, the Israelites did not have this duality between good and evil. That was something that came in later on, and we will see. Mostly it came from the Persians. You may remember that they carted off the scribes and the smart people and all that stuff to Babylon. Well, then what happens to Babylon 40 years later? The Persians come, whether it was Cyrus or Darius, and let them go back. So they were obviously acquainted with these different cultures. And Zoroaster, has anybody heard of him? Okay, great. Well, at 30, he had a revelation. And Ahura Mazda was their god. He was before he was a polytheist. And then he came up with there's one god, Ahura Mazda. But you see what Ahura is responsible for? Truth, justice, and good. And then whose anger mine you? Falsehood, deceit, and evil. So this is the idea that there's good and there's evil. That wasn't there before. Remember that quote about God? I am the light in darkness. I cause good. I create disaster. There wasn't an opposing force until, you know, kind of fairly late in the history. So when your team loses, Israelites get conquered, they're moving toward monotheism. So this notion of an afterlife starts. Well, okay, we got beat, but there's an afterlife. So we're going to get rewarded then. So this concept comes in. Very late, actually, Daniel, they think, was written about 200 BCE. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall wake, some to everlasting life, and some to reproaches and everlasting abhorrence. This comes in fairly late in the chronology of the Old Testament. And it's still not the heaven Christianity has where you go when you die. This is Sheol or Hades, you know, everyone goes there and they wait. And then sometimes there's going to be some kind of an apocalypse and people will be judged. So it's still a pretty basic idea. The Essenes were a group. Have you heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls? Okay, Qumran, they left Israel. They thought the Jews were being totally corrupt. They were male celibates. They went off to Qumran, and they were the good guys. They were the sons of light. And the ones who weren't following the Torah, who weren't doing what they should, they were the sons of darkness. And they were destroyed in 68 by the Romans. But this starts that duality, good, evil, lightness, darkness, etc. Another influence was the Gnostics, who, you know, it's all about spiritual knowledge. It's all about the hereafter. It's all about what you do through your mind. Who cares about material goods? They're not important. So you can see there's influences coming from different places about a duality of good and evil. Christianity significantly expands the role of the devil. And Elaine Pagel said once, how are you going to explain Jesus was crucified unless you got a devil? So this role of the snake to the accuser in Christianity comes full steam ahead to be the devil that we think of today that we transpose back to that first snake. And it explains why he was crucified. I'm not going to go through these, but there's multiple references in the New Testament. The devil plays a very active role, is responsible for Judas betraying Jesus, etc., etc. And then in Revelations, we really have the epitome, if you will, of the notion today we have of the Satan and the devil that gets kicked out of heaven. Well, that's nowhere in the Old Testament. Never happens. This is Christianity. This is totally new. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil, or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Do you know the Romans didn't have a notion of evil? You think it's, well, yeah, there's good and evil. They didn't have a notion of that. They didn't have that dichotomy. But they did lend the cloven hooves to the image of the devil through the god Pan. So what is the role of evil in religion? Does it serve it? If it didn't serve it, it probably wouldn't still be there. It explains disaster. Why bad things happen. Well, that's the devil. That's evil. It creates fear. If you don't go to church, if you don't tithe your 10%, you're going to go to hell. Well, that scares a lot of people, right? And I will save you. You create this terrible thing over here, hell, evil, Satan, and then you say, but you come to me, I will save you if you put your faith in. So it's very effective. And in the end, there'll be a cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil. So, we've talked about the snake representing the goddess. We talked about the snake in the Garden of Eden and how that got transposed to the devil we know today. And so I'm going to end with, how in the heck did the snake get on the caduceus for the doctor? Remember we talked about the snake? What was one of the things the snake did? Healing. And on your left is Asclepius, which had a rod with a snake. And this is Greek from a very long time ago. There was that symbol of the snake that came originally from the healing power of the snake, etc. And you see it with the rod there, and then you see it with the caduceus. The Malleus Maleficarum was written by two bishops. It was an excuse to kill witches. You know why? The doctors were coming into power. The male doctors. Who delivered babies? The midwives. Were the midwives women or men? Who were the gatherers? The women. Who knew about the herbs? Who could take away the pain? Who could stop the bleeding during childbirth? The women. Well, if you want to be a doctor, you want to get rid of the competition. There were hundreds of thousands of witches killed during this time. There was one village in Germany. There were only two women left in the village. They absolutely went crazy. We must add that in all these matters, witch midwives cause yet greater injuries, as penitent witches have often told us, yeah, sure, under torture. No one does more harm to the Catholic faith than midwives. For when they do not kill children, then as if for some other purpose, they take them out of the room and raising them up in the air, offer them to the devils. That was written in the 15th century. I'm going to jump ahead here as I close. The American Medical Association was formed in the 19th century. I did a talk a couple weeks ago about abortion and the history of abortion. Well, abortion was legal in the 19th century, just about for everybody. Catholic Church, it was up until quickening, which means when you feel the fetus. What happened then? American Medical Association, we want to get rid of those midwives. We want to get rid of the abortionists. There you go. What's interesting from the documents of the AMA, every phase of quackery is characterized by an overweening faith in drugs. Drugs, excuse me, do you watch TV? Do you see, what do doctors do now? Give out drugs, right? So that was from the 19th century. I thought that was really funny. An overweening faith in drugs and a delusive confidence in specifics, inspired by the brazen effrontery of the charlatans who by this craft have their gains. Look at the pharmaceuticals today. You might ask, why does it have wings? Okay, I get the snake thing, but what are the wings about? In 1902, one officer said, I want to use a symbol for the Marine Corps, the medical team of the Marine Corps, and so they added wings. So, the next time you go to your doctor, that symbol, ask them if they know about the snakes. So, we've gone from goddess to Satan to doctor. And that's how culture changes and how it's reproduced and how it's used for different means. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Okay, if you have any questions, just raise your hand and I'll bring you the microphone.
The first thing is, I wonder why, you know, because of what a snake looks like, why didn't it become a phallic symbol in the beginning? You know, because, I mean, of what a snake looks like.
Become a what?
A phallic symbol. Symbol
that's
of the penis. Because.
Well, it was very, remember when you see a snake move, it moves in curves. Mm. It's not a straight line. I think that may have been, that would have. May have been difficult to use it as that symbol.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
And the other point I wanted to make.
That's kind of a guess on my part.
In another life, I was Eastern Orthodox, which is, people think it's like Catholicism, but it's actually Catholicism and Protestantism are much more similar to each other than either is to Eastern Orthodox, and Eastern Orthodox still maintains today the same dogma and beliefs and everything that it had like in the 3rd century. So it's as far back as you can go. And so we're a lot more aware of like what the original meanings were of things. And the Old Testament, or what used to be the Talmud, and all the Jewish writings actually were written as allegory, and the early church did understand these stories as allegory. Genesis, all these, they weren't to be taken, like the numbers and stuff, as literal facts. And for like the first 1,000 years, the Christian church didn't believe, because the Jews never believed and still don't, in like a literal burning hell. That mm-hmm. is a new thing. It was a state of being separate, and the idea would feel like fire because you felt, you know, regret or whatever, but it was never like a physical place of torture. And at the same time, the devil wasn't like another evil god the way that like the Protestants mm-hmm. later, like today's Protestants kind of yes. almost put him up to be a god. And to this day, the Orthodox, you know, and certainly substitutionary atonement, a lot of things, they're just like, my God, that's disgusting, you know. But a lot of people forget that the actual original Christianity was yeah. a lot more like Judaism, you know. And to this day, Judaism doesn't have a hell, and to this day, abortion has never been forbidden in Judaism.
Yeah.
And if a mother has children and is pregnant with a possibly medically dangerous pregnancy, she's not forced by any means, but the rabbi usually persuades her to have an abortion for the sake of her other children. So you see a totally different frame
yeah,
of mind.
Yeah, interesting. So, mm-hmm. There is a book by Harold Bloom called The Story of Jay. And Jay, there's four oral strains of the Old Testament, at least four. Jay for Jehovah, E for Elohim, D for Deuteronomy, and P for Priestley. And Harold Bloom proposes that Jay was a woman and that may have written those parts, the oldest parts of the Old Testament, or the Tanakh as it's referred to in Judaism, around the time of Rehoboam. And it was a fascinating book. Somebody contacted me who has written a very scholarly book saying that not only was Jay a woman, it was all written as satire. It was not to be taken literally. So I really hope she can get her book published and out there, because it'll be a fascinating read. But thank you for adding that. I'll have to check that out. It's very interesting.
Did you have a question?
Oh, thank you. We talk about abortion, and obviously if something's permitted, there's got to be a way of doing it. I only know what little I know about abortion, about therapeutic abortion. I've heard that apparently there were certain emetics that you could take at least a couple hundred years ago that could affect an abortion. But how would a midwife do this? I'm a little bit curious.
Google abortifacient. You will find a formula on the website of different plants and herbs that could cause an abortion. Now, I just have to add here, the Revised Standard Version that I grew up with has a story in Numbers chapter 5 about the man who said, my wife committed adultery, but I don't have the two witnesses. So he goes to the rabbi, and it's this real vague thing that happens, and it's totally unclear. Well, the New International Version now says, you will put a curse on her. She will drink this liquid, and it will flow from her loins. So there was abortion in the Old Testament. People knew how to do it. I mean, there in the Roman Empire, etc., it was through some sort of herbal treatment. But go look at it on the web. It's really interesting to see that you can still find that today. We're giving you color exercise for tonight.
It's just over the use of the symbol of the snake around a stick. I'm a PhD in epidemiology, and that's often referred to in textbooks of being a removal method for a particularly nasty parasite, which is long and which will look like a snake. I'll talk to you afterwards, but I'm just saying that's where that symbol that is often cited as coming from, at least in parasitology textbooks.
Interesting.
I'm not entirely sure if you want to talk about it afterwards.
I would be happy.
Yeah,
happy
I just thought I'd mention that.
Yes.
So it might be a completely different thing, and maybe that the two are sort of intertwined on the same sort of trick.
It could be. Thank you.
Thanks for the talk. And you mentioned early on that, sorry, I'll go to the center so it doesn't squeak. You mentioned religion is the last deterrent to gender equity. I'm curious if you can speak a little bit about how you feel, do you feel that all religions play an equal role in deterring gender equity, or is there a particular religion that you think could be play a positive role?
I think, you know, there's a huge comparison and difference between the United States and Saudi Arabia. When I was reading all this mythology about the feminine divine, I said, why didn't you fight back? Why didn't you fight back when they destroyed Asherah's pole? There's a passage in Jeremiah saying, we're going to go back to the Queen of Heaven. When we worshiped the Queen of Heaven and wrote in and burned incense to her, we did really well. So you can see all through the Old Testament there was this struggle. But in Saudi Arabia today, there are women who are doctors, highly educated. They can't change the system to be able to drive a car. Not to be able to drive a car. So, and in those societies, you know, the religion and the state, there's no separation of church and state. So it's, you have to get rid of the religion to change the state, if you will. Now, obviously, we have it much better. When I was at Concordia, I applied for a scholarship to Dartmouth. Interested in going to graduate school there. The only woman on the committee said to me, why should we give it to you? You'll just get married and have children. I didn't get the scholarship. When I was director of the bar, there was a subsidiary, and the person left and they were going to hire somebody new. I said to my board, I got 90 people on staff, they got 40. Here's the hierarchy of me, my deputy. This is where this person should go. What did they do? They hired him $30,000 more than I was making. And I went to the board, and one of the attorneys on the board, it was a woman, said, if you want to sue us, let me know, I'll help you. They hired an HR consultant who said, Karen has more responsibility. There's absolutely no comparison. The only thing I can come up with is sex discrimination. I got a $30,000 raise. So, thank you, thank you. It certainly changed my final average salaries for the calculation of my income. It was great. So, obviously, there's discrimination today. And if you look at one of the women, the first essay in my book was raised fundamentalist. And she says, after 30 years of leaving religion, I still feel the devil's looking over me. So I think a lot of religion, even in the United States, can do harm. There's a quiver fill movement where people are just supposed to have child after child after child. There's the fundamentalists of the Mormon church, etc. There are many denominations where a woman cannot be part of it. Now, there are certain religions, there are churches like the Unitarian Universalist, that are much more accepting of women. I just moved to a small town in Oregon and was doing a soup kitchen at one of the Lutheran churches, and the pastor's a woman. And I really want to sit down and talk to her. They said she was very smart, you know. But I don't think on a global scale, we as women will be free to do anything we want to as long as there's religion. Because remember, it's just not what you believe. Look what's happening with the government. Who's worried about Roe v. Wade being overturned? Thank you. So we may think we have it pretty good here. That could change with one vote by the Supreme Court. So I do believe it's a major factor.
We'll take one more question.
It's back to history, and it was kind of a great place to end with the current situation. But historically, one of the things that I have seen, I'm really interested in archaeology, and particularly in Italy, in pre-Roman archaeology, and they have very similar figures to the ones you showed in your slide, the little stone carved figures that were essentially votives. They found piles and piles and piles of them. And many of them have a goddess figure who is holding in her arms either a pig or a lamb. And you can see, it was interesting, I was with my mother in this archaeological museum, and she said, look, Rebecca, it's exactly like a Madonna figure. You can see that this essentially evolved to a Madonna figure. And so I'm really curious your take on the relationship between the goddess figures and the incorporation of Mary. So I'd like to hear that.
That's a very, very good point. I told you about the in Jeremiah said we're going to go back to worship the Queen of Heaven. Well, when they changed to an all-male deity, there was a thirst for a feminine figure. And what's interesting is the Holy Spirit is based on the notion of Sophia, which is a female embodiment of wisdom. So you've got something there, and that kind of got chilled out. But the Virgin Mary was elevated every few hundred years, even up until the 19th century. I think there was even a 20th century edict of giving her more and more of a place. And there were saints who were women. So there was something there in Catholicism, at least not a lot. I mean, who can aspire to be a virgin mother? That might be tricky today. It was tricky then, too. So I think the Catholic Church was responding to a need to that. And when Martin Luther and Calvin came along, they totally eliminated that. And I never thought, because of course I never heard about this being raised as a Lutheran, they eliminated any reference to women at all in the religion. It became totally male-centered. So it's but I do think the Catholic Church did that on purpose. Thank you very much for your attention.